Les colloques du Collège de France.
Our last speaker for today, not least, is Claire Wyatt. Claire is from Paris at the Institut de...
Du cerveau.
I'm always confused with the... Yeah, du cerveau.
I changed.
Brain Institute. And so thank you, Claire, for coming.
Thank you. So actually, I'm going to start to take you out of the forest by first thanking Thomas for organizing this really nice meeting and for caring in the little detail of... not getting people lost or losing their jacket or not being on time. So thank you very much, Thomas, for organizing with such precision. And then I'm going to try, if you're still a little bit alert, to make you decide. So I put in the schedule that I will talk about a new topic that we work on in the lab, which is about navigation and individuality. But hearing the talks, I felt like, you know, we have found... you know, a sensory system that detects curvature of the body that has implication for development. And so if people are more interested by development, I prepared two options. So are you guys more interested about sensing curvature at the level of the body? Or are you open-minded just before getting your beer to talk about navigation? Oops.
It's a one-bit decision.
Yeah, you go, you know, either development and curvature or like navigation. Or beer. No, do you, anyone? I still, you know?
I think you have to decide.
Well,
which one are you more excited about?
Well, so I like to talk about the new stuff, but the truth is that with you guys, I feel actually that I should get, you know, it would be interesting to have your feedback. So just for Lisa, I'll decide on the development, I think. Because you're awake. No, just kidding. No, but it's true that it's... Okay, so we have one. Okay, so I just need a third person to make the decision. Anyone?
I vote morphogenesis.
Morphogenesis, you vote? Okay. Yeah, so it's a little bit more, you know. Yeah, exactly. But that's where I kind of want to have the feedback. No, it's actually quite... it's quite interesting to have your feedback on this. So I'm gonna switch and I'm not gonna follow the plan of the talk. So yes, we're really curious, starting in fact to think about sensory integration at the level of the body in vertebrates, to understand how animals are able to sense the position of their body in space. And if you look at the textbook, typically you see that most of the information, in fact, all in the neuroscience textbooks, come from the periphery. So you have sensor in your fingers, on the muscle spindle, sensor that are connected to your tendon, and those are giving information on your limbs. But there is absolutely no indication that you have a way to tell where your spine is and where your trunk is. And so that's what we worked on. And it's an interesting topic to discuss with people who are modeling or are interested in morphogenesis, because we still haven't really figured out how it works. So it's more interesting maybe to get your feedback. So you guys have probably observed and noticed that even though, you know, we're very cerebral and intellectuals, our body a little bit tells the truth about our state. And so we're going to play a game where if I ask you, how are these people, you know, in which state those people are, when you look at this, what would you say? Are they bored? Are they tired? Are they sick? Yeah, happy and ecstatic. They're maybe at a concert.
Zumba.
Yeah, they're Zumba. And then is this person there. What do you think? Yeah, you're dancing like this. That's a little sad. So, who is not dancing like this? What do you think these people can be? Adjectives.
Old, tired.
Maybe also sick. What do you think? What do you think? Yeah. What do you think? The young lady here. That could be, yes. What else?
Looking
over. Could be. Maybe the picture was like trying to kiss, indeed, so Thomas had it. And then what do you think these people are doing?
Walking in the street.
Yeah, and there are more and more. And this one is something we don't see that often, but it's good to actually bring it up, full of energy. So our body actually tells a lot about our state, and it's both a process that is dynamic. So when you actually, you know, adjust right away to sensory stimulation, but it's also a long-term process where sadly with time and stress and age and infection, in fact, you get to deform. You continue to grow. And you get the body to be deformed, including the spine itself. And so there are the very interesting patient that you can see in Pitié Salpêtrière. Data come from there where the patients are completely able to lay down and straight in the bed. But as soon as they stand, they cannot be straight. And their body forms almost a 90 degree angle. I'm sure you've seen them when you go to the market, or you see people like struggling just to walk in that. And so there's this very interesting question of like, how do we sense our body curvature, but also how does it evolve over time, and how do we maintain this body curvature so that our axis at the midline level is straight, even though we have a different, you know, curvature of the spine itself. And so the way typically, like summarizing the field of neuroscience, the way typically things work is that you have sensory inputs that most, for 99%, have been studied on the exteroception, so the information that comes from outside. And then this information leads to a motor response, typically a reflex that can be, you know, the Babinski reflex in your spinal cord with very few neurons. It can be an integrative reflex that takes information from you know, many senses and is integrated in your brainstem. And then you have feedback always. And what is really interesting is that those internal states, the spark that you're sick, you're tired, you're hungry, you're angry, you have like many, many reasons to change state, and those, in fact, are going to modulate in many ways via neuromodulation and other paths this transformation, so that not only you will integrate sensory information differently, but you will also show a different posture and a different ability to locomote, run, fly, or swim. And so that's really an interesting path. And if we go on the question of proprioception and how information is sent so that we know where our body is in space, even though we don't consciously think about it, you know, you don't need to be a yogi to feel like your spine is moving when you do exercise and different activity. And it's true that if you look at the textbook, the work of Sherrington with the information coming from the periphery and the tip of our finger or tendon, you know, is very indirect to know where is my spine. And so when we started the lab, we really wanted to understand this and to figure out where is information that tells us where our spine is. And we got interested by this interface with the cerebrospinal fluid, this complex solution, almost like a soup, full of tons of metabolites, neurotransmitters, neuromodulators that are coming out from your brain, and that is also able to impact not only the rest of your nervous system, brain and spinal cord, but also the organ in your body. And so it's generated in the choroid plexus, and it flows throughout the cavity of the ventricle, and it goes down in the spinal cord here at the level of the central canal. And so when I was doing my postdoc, I had the luck to work with Ethan Scott, who was coming from Drosophila, and he had done a very nice enantiotrope of screen. And I was looking for lines to work on. And in one of those enantiotrope lines, I found that there were cells that looked like the cells that Pascal Martin in the room is really interested by, even though they are not as organized in their microvilli. So instead of having this nice staircase of the hair cells in the ear, they look more like, you know, coils. They have like disorganized microvilli, and they are surrounding this green structure, the Reisner fiber, that had been identified a long time ago in the 1900s. So Colmer and Agdew described those cells during the First World War. They went into zoo and different farms, and they described and drew those cells with Golgi staining in over 100 species. There were two anatomists who worked in German about the cells. They were convinced that these cells were forming a sensory organ, but they were fighting about the red arrow, the fact that the Reisner fiber was interacting with these cells. And so Colmer was convinced that the cells must be a third ear in the spinal cord, and Agdew was saying it's just an artifact of fixation. So we call these neurons CSF contacting neuron. And just for anyone who didn't escape for a beer in the young generation, Reisner fiber, when he described the fiber, he could do a paper with a single figure and just a ruler. He made a drawing of the central canal in the lamprey and of the Reisner fiber just like that. That was the only figure of the paper in 1860. And he said, there is a fiber extracellular in the central canal. And then thanks to electronic microscopy, you can see it in many species. It's there in numerous species, but somehow not in all. Like we can find it in the camel, and now we're looking for it in humans. We don't know. The really extremely puzzling and fascinating, you know, thing about this fiber is that it's made of one monomer, which is called SCO-spondin. And SCO-spondin has an amidomain here that enables the aggregation just at the beginning of it. And then you see it has tons of highly conserved parts, including the LDL receptor, TSR, WD motifs. And it's a gigantic protein. It's like 5,000 amino acids. So it's a massive, massive protein. And so when we started the team, we looked with Lydia, the first student, for these cells across species, and we find that both in macaque, in mice, and in zebrafish, they're always those microvillated cells with one cilium and tons of microvilli actin-based, and they are very numerous in the macaque spinal cord, in cervical, thoracic, and lumbar. They stay throughout the life of the animal, and they are inhibitory neurons with a taste receptor that is sufficient and necessary to get you the sour taste in the tongue. So very mysterious why we would have sour tasting in the spinal cord. We have a way with zebrafish to target genetically the cells, but also to look at all the cells in an animal just with confocal microscopy, because the spinal cord is not that deep. And then we can drive expression in these cells using the PA12-1 promoter. So the second grad student, Urs Böhm, who is now a team leader in EPNP, did this experiment testing the idea of cormorant actor, of seeing whether the cell could detect the curvature of the spine when the animal bends actively or passively its tail. And what Urs found, summarized here, is that if the animal bends on the left side, what you get is that only the CSF contacting neurons on the left side are active. And in the knockout for PKI2L1, we have no more response. So they need the sour receptor to detect the compression. And so it was really puzzling to understand how it worked, and we continued the investigation with Jenna Stenberg, where we recorded these cells using patch clamp in the in vivo, and we saw something quite remarkable, that the cells are so resistive that when we come with a pipette, we perforate the membrane, we're looking at the signal in whole cell, we have single ion, you know, opening, channel opening. So we see the single, you know, channel opening of the PKI2L1, you know, tropic receptor here, opening back and forth in the control wild type and not in the mutant where there is no more channel opening. And when Jenna now plated these cells in culture and pushed with a piezo 4 micron against the membrane, she saw that she could change the opening probability of the channel so that it's a slow response. It's not like piezo that you have, you know, in the tendon or in the muscle spindle. It's a slow response, but you modulate the opening probability by using pressure. And it's not happening in the mutant for PKI2L1. So then we went on looking at flow in the cerebrospinal fluid, at first with beads, and we used dynamic current tomography, so from the Langevin Institute with Claude Bogard and Olivier Touvenin. We had like really nice movies where we can look at the particles that are numerous in the during embryogenesis using OCT. And then we find you know, a collaboration with François Galère in EPFL and Ludovic Kaiser to model the flow, and we saw that it was bidirectional in the embryo. And this bidirectional flow was very well explained by cilia that are motile only in the ventral part of the canal, and they are beating with a tilt that generates the flow from head to tail in the ventral side. And because the central canal is closed at the end, at the beginning during embryogenesis, then you just have recirculation. And this flow, in fact, is really useful for diffusion of large particles above 20 nanometer. It doesn't make much of a difference for small molecules, but for large particles, it does. And so we labeled those exosomes that can also be mid-bodies with CD63 fluorine in a transgenic line, and we see the same dynamic that we can see bidirectional during embryogenesis and then unidirectional in the larva.
Sorry, how
thick? The central canal itself is only 8 micron here, so it's very small. The fiber is 250 nanometer. So we thought initially, our first idea was that these cells are detecting flow when the animal is moving, and that's how they can sense the curvature. And we did recordings where we had the flow in an animal that was not paralyzed, and we saw that when the motion artifact occurs, it's followed by a flush where suddenly the beads are going much more from rostral to caudal. And this is due to a peristatic pump effect that the animal has muscle around the central, like around the spinal cord, the same that we have axial musculature ourselves. And this is leading to an effect of head-to-tail contraction of the muscle that lead to the change of flow inside the central canal. And so when we record the cell at the same time, we see that they're also responding for every contraction. So we initially thought, well, maybe they're just sensing the flow. And then we thought a little bit more, and we realized, discussing with François Galère, also in EPFL, that, you know, the way to detect a change of flow, if it's just slightly tiny little tilt there, when you have, you know, null flow at the wall of the central canal and it's maximum in the center, is actually very tricky for ciliated cells, because you need to be able to see a very small delta of the flow there. It's not that easy. And so we went back to the fight of Colmer and Hagder, and we thought, well, maybe the answer is in the fiber. Maybe, in fact, it's the fiber that interacts with the cell and enables the detection of the curvature. And so Pierre-Luc Bardet, who now is a professor in Sorbonne University, was also coming from Drosophila, and also, you know, very eager to get new reagent to the fish. So he was the first, you know, CRISPR-Cas that we did in the lab, and he decided to target the first exon of the scosponin. And so he went and targeted the EMI domain here, and because he's like really careful, he did the first allele, ICM13, as a null allele with a stop codon right away. And he find another one where he had 15 nucleotide added to the gene and 5 amino acid in the protein. And he decided to keep it and to see whether he would have possibly an hypomorph in this allele. What he found using immunohistochemistry for an antibody that recognizes the cow Reisner fiber, that is so conserved that it works in other species, that you have the fiber in the wild type in the central canal here, no fiber in the null allele, but surprisingly no fiber either in the hypomorph, where just 5 amino acid added to this EMI domain forbid the aggregation of scosponin in a fiber. So you have a way to look at animals that have no fiber but are still secreting the protein scosponin. And so we looked in EM, and we find with CLEM that the fiber, it's hard to see, the CSF is super dense with protein, and the fiber is here, very small and surrounded by tons of ciliated cells. Some are ependymal radial glia, and some are the little neuron that we, you know, look at, the CSF contacting neurons. And so Adeline in the lab did experiments where she now tested, if I have the mutant without the fiber, do I still get the cell to respond to curvature? And what she found is that in the siblings, she had clear response to every contraction and compression on the side of the cell. In the mutant ICM15 with no fiber, no more response to curvature. So the fiber interacts with the cell to detect curvature. And then we looked at a knock-in made by Ryan Gray in the US, and we saw that the fiber is actually a dynamic thing. It's really interesting. You see, it's straight like the ruler of Reisner, like the way he described it in 1860 for the lamprey. It's super straight. And if your eyes can see it, it's moving. And it's a little bit like a spiritism session when you look at it, because you feel like, is it really moving? Does it? Yeah, it does. So we've done a lot of algorithms to actually like look at the movement. It's moving really, really fast. We think it's moving, you know, we're probably under sampling to know exactly at which frequency it's fluctuating, but it's moving, you know, extremely fast. And we have very little signal to be able to record above typically 90 hertz. So we could estimate that, you know, that it's clearly having those light undulation and almost waves sometimes. And we started to do experiments where we ablate the fiber and see what happens. And so we noticed two things. So the first is that the fiber have this really cool interaction with cilia. So we label not all cilia in this transgenic line, but some of the cilia on the top. And you can see that many of them have their tip touching. And some of them have the tip touching and coming, touch and go. Many of the cilia are tilted toward the caudal side. And in fact, one of the things we wonder is whether the cilia are useful, something that we discussed with Jean-François, are actually having this weak interaction with the fiber in order to put the fiber in tension. The cells, the CSF contacting neurons labeled here in the bottom video, are fluctuating, like their activity is flickering when the fiber is oscillating. They are like chatouillés, you know, they are like tickled, and they actually are active spontaneously. If we cut the fiber, there is no more spontaneous activity in the sensory system. And so with Françoise and then Jean-François, Joanny, we've done a mechanical model to understand the weird properties of this fiber. So Céline Bellagarda did the experiment where we come with a UV laser pulsed, and then we break the fiber in the center. And so this is very much slowed down. And we see this beautiful retraction where the fiber is under tension, and in the point it breaks, it relaxes and it forms what my mother liked to call a flower, where it goes away with time. And because she had worked on a similar system a long time ago, we started to build a mechanical model together to understand how does it retract from the point where we cut it. And so Céline did all the experiments on many, many animals, looking at many fibers that she would cut at different positions along the rostrocaudal axis. And then at first Françoise and then with Jean-François, we looked at, you know, the forces that could put the fiber, in this tense state where when we cut it, it relaxes and it relaxes with this retraction x that is proportional just to the square root of the time. And so we started to look at plotting this retraction distance as a function of the square root of time. And when we did that, we saw indeed, you know, beautiful curve where for data in FIFO, we find it really nice that you get like a really like nice linear relationship as expected from the mechanical model. And then sometimes, instead of just continuing to retract, the fiber gets stuck. And it gets stuck often again on cilia. That's where we're thinking that there is an interesting sticky relationship between the fiber and cilia. And when it gets stuck for very long. So sometimes it's like the whole duration of the experiment. And then sometimes it gets stuck and then it jumps and it goes again. So it can continue to, you know, stick and then to retract again. And when you look at it, you know, I don't go into detail, but it's really interesting because it's a polymer, a cellular outside the cells, yet it looks very much alive. It has like tons of really cool properties and aggregation that we still want to understand. So we calculated the diffusion coefficient of the fiber based on this, and then we came out with this idea that we have a fiber under tension, and when we bent left, right, or ventrally, the cells are positioned in the right place to actually sense the polymer, you know, next to their ciliated brush, and they're able to respond, and it activates a lot more there than if they don't have the fiber and they show very small response. So we have a model, and it was again a conversation kind of got us back thinking about the different possibility of, you know, is it just that the ciliated brush sees a gradient because the flow is null on the fiber, and that's what's getting them activated, is that they have an enhanced gradient? Or could it be that they interact with the fiber itself? And so that's something that, discussing again with Thomas last year, we got excited again from the work of Drosophila of seeing that they are super cool adhesion receptors that are GPCR receptors often and not known. And so we're investigating this now, and together with other GPCR, we think that there is in fact a very complex interaction where the PGE2L1 is clearly necessary to boost the response of the cell, but it's not the only receptor in these cells, and they're using GPCR as well. So we are still in the pipeline. I don't have, I can't show you the data yet. It's not finished. But so to bring it back to morphogenesis, we started by looking a lot at behavior and how animal locomote and how they keep their posture. And to make a long story short, what we saw is that when you don't have this sensory system, you locomote more slowly. And when you're challenged, like here is an animal challenged with doing a startle response where we use an acoustic stimulus coming from the right, and the animal does this really fast escape with a C-bend and it goes away from the stimulus. Try to see if I could replay that. And it stays very stable when it does so. But when the cells are missing, what is surprising is that not only they go more slowly, but they also lose balance. So they start to roll. And so we developed an algorithm using AI to recognize the rolling. And we saw that compared to the textbook where only the vestibular system is useful to know, you know, where you are in space, you actually use information from the spinal cord. And what is very exciting is that this is not only a story of fish, which have a very long tail, use their tail to locomote. It's true as well for the mouse. So a paper last year from Germany and another from Japan have shown that in the mouse as well, when you challenge the mouse and they are on a small rod or on a big ladder with big steps, without this cell, they also mess up and they fall. And so it's really fun to think, well, how does it work? And so we establish the circuitry with optogenetics. They are activated by compression. They recruit excitatory neuron and motor neuron, and the one that are the most rostral are actually going in the brain to even modulate the activity of motor neuron, but also key command neuron. In the brain that are really important for behavior. So this is very conserved and similar the pattern of connectivity in the mouse. And now what I'd like, you know, to maybe open the discussion and have a beer to discuss it further with you is that the really interesting thing that is very mysterious is that when you lack the fiber, you can't grow a straight body. And so it's very neat, completely unexpected. But when Pierre-Luc did his first CRISPR-Cas, you know, mutant in the lab, the first thing he saw is that the embryo don't grow a straight body. They grow a curled body. And both alleles show the same. And when you look at the PGE2L1 mutant, you have a different deformation that is actually occurring only in the adult stage. And that looks more like Sherman disease, where it's a 2D deformation, and it's mainly for male in fish, like it is for male in humans. And the scospondin, if you raise the animal, will get a 3D deformation of scoliosis. So with this in mind, we're really interested to understand how it works and how not only you need the sensory system to detect the straight spine in embryogenesis, but also throughout life. And so some of the elements have come from work in our lab and others where we understand that the ventral CSF contacting neuron express a urotensin-related peptide from the U2 family. And Daniel Grimes and the lab of Guillaume Pezeron in Paris have shown that, in fact, those peptides have receptors in the dorsal musculature that are critical for getting the body straight in the embryo. And they can really be important for keeping it straight in the adult. So there is really an interesting, you know, path to understand in that direction. And we're really curious to see what are the other chemo signaling going on, because it's such an important thing to have a straight body and to keep it straight that it clearly seems to be, in fact, involving many players. How much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Perfect. So what is quite fun, if you guys also know a little bit about meningitis, is that, you know, the cerebrospinal fluid is used by doctors for detecting what happens when you have you know, a possibility of suffering from an infection, or when you could have a disease and have an inflammation and so on. So doctors use always the spinal tap to know what is in the CSF. And so we got pretty excited when we did the transcriptome of these neurons, because we find that not only they have the receptor that could be involved in mechanosensing, but they also have often this receptor and many receptors for molecules that are in the cerebrospinal fluid. And we started to get this crazy idea that maybe they could be tasting the inside of your, you know, cerebrospinal fluid to have an idea of what the state is and possibly respond in the context of spinal cord injury or in the context of an infection that typically a bacteria or a virus that could lead to an infection. And it's true that we were not, you know, molecular people, so coming from more biophysics and the neuroscience, we validated our transcriptome. We looked at over, at this point, 60 genes and confirmed their expression, and we found all those really interesting protein and peptide that are important for innate immunity and receptors as well. And thinking more about posture and infection, we realized that when you get meningitis, the way people tell is by having, you know, the stiffness of the neck. You cannot, you know, move your neck as much, and that's the sign that you should really get treatment and antibiotics. If you don't get treatment and you don't receive antibiotics, that doesn't happen, thankfully, much in our country, but what happens is that you will show opisthotonos, where your body goes backbent, like the picture I showed at the beginning, and you can't get out of the backbend. And so we've tried this crazy idea that this sensory system could maybe also detect a bacterial infection. And we find that indeed when a bacteria enters the CSF, the neurons are massively activated and it goes along with this curvature dorsal nerve of the body, which is typically the symptom of an activation of these cells. And so without going into detail, this looked very much like opisthotonos in humans when we didn't have antibiotics, as a painting of that. And now we're looking at the genetic cause for scoliosis, where, you know, it's 8 adolescent girls for 1 boy in our country. There are so many genes that are found as recessive in the families where it comes along. And we're really excited that many of those genes find from patients are leading to deformation in the fish. So I'll finish by just saying we have identified this sensory pathway. We are not developmental biologists. We're not modeling how a body grows, but we're really excited to talk with people who are going in that direction, because we find that we have the tools to, in fact, using mutation and also the driver line, we have to play with asymmetry. And in particular, now we get mutants where we just get defect to the left or defect to the right in the body. So we really would like to discuss more with this community. And so to summarize, we have a sensory system that is mechanosensory and chemosensory that impacts posture and also the characteristic and kinetics of locomotion. And it has also a chemosensory function that are important for innate immunity, for spinal cord injury, I didn't have time to show, and for morphogenesis. So thank you very much, and I hope we can continue the conversation.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.